Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. War is the lowest form of human behavior, and so is hypocrisy. Western elites support the wars in Ukraine and Israel, but their publics don't. Another casualty is the war on free speech. Conservatives beclown themselves for demanding an Israel exception. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Goggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He is an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. The hypocrisy is becoming more and more obvious. I mean, it was pretty obvious in the beginning, but now it's just in plain sight for everyone to see, particularly in how the war in Gaza is being presented to Western publics. Even some of the videos that they claim is in support of Israel's Gaza is actually the reverse, okay? Or they're very unconvincing, showing a roster of who is watching the hostages underneath the Al-Shafa hospital. Actually, it was just a calendar in Arabic, okay? And then we have American Jews against Zionism being portrayed as, you know, riotous and out of control. But no, the police are the ones that are riotous and out of control. So it's really turning everything upside down. And as I said in my introduction, these wars in Ukraine and in Israel, at least for Gaza, they're demanding a ceasefire across the board, something that's bipartisan in the public. And the war in Ukraine is becoming less and less popular among people, but elites don't change. And that's the hypocrisy, George.
Well, that's absolutely right. And of course, during the now almost 2 years of this war in Ukraine, I mean, we had many occasions to point out that while the elites of Europe, all the Ursula von der Leyen's and then the Boris Johnson and the Rishi Sunak's and the Macron's and the Sergeant Schultz's, they're constantly talking about Ukraine, constantly berating Russia, there was no echo among the public. Now, not once did we see any demonstrations against Russia. Not once did we see any mass rallies outside the Russian embassy anywhere. It was, as far as the public was concerned, this was a war that should never have started, and that it was that this is something that a government project. Now, the same thing is happening in the case of Israel. Clearly, the public in Europe and in the United States wants a ceasefire. All the polls show it. The mass demonstrations that we see in so many places, they all demand a ceasefire. But how do the elites respond to that? Well, they keep talking about October the 7th. So, you know, how much? It's already been more than a month since October the 7th. They still talk about October the 7th. You pick up any major newspaper, there's always going to be yet another story about what really happened on October the 7th and how people feel and how they responded to whatever, because they continue want to generate this as a means of ensuring support for what Israel is doing. So, you know, however much they may report, you know, this or that, you know, the Al-Shifa hospital and so on, you know, that's bad. Or, yeah, now it's supposed to be 11,000 Palestinian civilians are dead. Oh, but let's go back to October the 7th. How did you feel about when you read about October the 7th?
And of course, you know, networks like CNN, they have partnered up with the IDF so that, you know, they can be given a chaperoned view of things. OK, completely sanitized. There are plenty of outlets that are showing, well, quite frankly, gentlemen, some of the most horrific things I've ever seen in my life. OK, it is so horrific. But George brought up October 7th. Well, Martin, well, what actually did happen on October 7th? Because that is a very animated, vivid conversation in Israel itself, but doesn't seem to get further than that. It's really it's astounding on how much Western media outlets will stick to a narrative when in Israel itself it is hotly contested. Martin.
Yeah, I mean, journalists don't really like to jump about with their narratives and, you know, follow this adage, only a fool never changes his mind. Not at all. When we jet into war zones around the world, generally journalists like to stick to a single narrative. And when they arrived in Ukraine, you know, the narrative was already crafted for them and then cultivated even further by a formidable fake news operation in Kiev, funded by the Americans, of course. Same story in all the wars I've covered, going right back to Yugoslavia. And I think, you know, the same things happened in Israel. One of the things that the narrative is very hell bent on doing is creating a starting point. This right. is where the news starts. You know, so don't waste your time looking at background and nuances. Don't waste your time Googling. It starts on this date. You know, so with Ukraine, of course, it was when the Russians invaded, and now with Israel, it's October the 7th. But your question, very good question, I might say, Peter. I think it's going to haunt an awful lot of people, because what we're seeing now is there are a few journalists, a very, very small cabal of journalists who don't accept the October the 7th narrative and are starting to look very, very closely at video and other forensic evidence about what did happen. And what you see when you scrape away the surface, you see a lot of these attacks on the kibbutz were not only from Hamas firing AK-47s at these poor people. I'm not defending it at all. It was appalling. But also the IDF turned up and then put and weighed in themselves. And because what we are not reading from Western journalists is the IDF and Israel has a very, very strong policy, a rather extraordinary policy in not letting hostages being taken. And we don't read this a lot, but that is the truth. And so the kibbutz killings, a lot of them now, you know, there's an excellent journalist in Israel called Jonathan Cook, who's exposed the kibbutz killings and the BBC coverage of them, you know, and the same thing goes for the pop concert. If you actually look at the video footage, which is available, even the IDF are showing it, you have hundreds of cars which are just shot to pieces by high caliber machine guns, which can only come from tanks, you know. So that's when the IDF turned up and probably saw a panic ensue of hundreds of people escaping or being caught and driving in all sorts of directions, and they had to be stopped because IDF does not allow its own people to be taken prisoners. And that's the flip side to the October 7th story, which is not being reported at all. You know, but I think I think we are living in an unprecedented age of fake news, which we've never seen before. Nothing on this scale before, not in Ukraine, not in Syria. You know, these amateur videos that the IDF are just flooding the internet with, you know, are backfiring on such a big way. I mean, the whole world is basically mocking them.
I'm glad you brought that up, because even this morning I saw a number of these fake videos, amateur videos supported by the Israeli state or Israeli media outlets. And if you've been watching a number of news outlets that actually have unfettered access, and you look at the videos, these horrific videos, and then you look at the fake ones, I mean, it just kind of, you know, laugh up your sleeve. I mean, there's not even comparable. You know, George, one of the interesting things about the story of October 7th is that it kind of puts in relief in a very sharp way, is that the IDF is willing to kill Palestinians en masse. It looks like they do it against their own people, too, if necessary. Yeah. George.
Yes. No question. I think a lot of very good work has been done by Max Blumenthal.
Yes, I saw his interview with Chris Hedges. It was very good.
Yes, and that's clearly been the case. And so, you know, we really were sold a bill of goods after October the 7th, because the story that was put out about the 1,400 Israelis massacred, you know, that came accompanied by horror stories about mass rapes, beheaded babies, babies being burnt in ovens. Again, you know, babies being ripped out of women's wombs and so on. All of that was essentially put out by the Israeli propaganda machine and were eagerly repeated and rehashed, particularly in the United States among all the pundits. And so then, you know, these are the barbarians that we are dealing with. But interestingly enough, apparently these horrific inhuman barbarians, well, right now they're negotiating some kind of a release of hostages with the Israeli government and mediated by the United States and Qatar. So how can they be such horrific barbarians if they're sitting there working out some kind of a hostage deal, largely releasing women and children? But it was very important from the start to maintain this propaganda story. That's why you just keep repeating and repeating it, even as more and more of this information is coming out, and particularly about how the Israelis just simply were shooting all over the place. You know, they're just pitilessly, when they knew exactly what they were doing, that they were killing their own people. And yet that same Israeli killing machine kept putting out this story about that it was all Hamas, just all, they were all, you know, mass slaughter.
Well, it's interesting, and it's actually quite terrifying, Martin, is that some of the commentary, thoughtful commentary about what happened on October 7th and the Israelis that were killed, it was pointed out to me that they weren't Netanyahu supporters, which kind of puts a chill down your spine.
Well, I wonder how many supporters he's got at the moment. You know, I think we talk a lot about opinion polls around the world, but I wonder how many people within Israel now would support a continuation of what's going on in Gaza. You know, it's a really sad situation. I don't think we've ever seen a more servile, a more incestuous relationship with Western media and Israel as we see today. And I think this is partly feeding into the madness of Netanyahu, and the way he thinks is that he knows that whatever happens, no matter how bad things get, we don't only have media, big media, in our pocket. You know, we can control absolutely everything that they do. I mean, we need on-screen symbols. When CNN reporter falls down in the mud and she looks at the camera and she's out of breath, you know, and she's talking about what's going on, we need a title on the screen which says this was basically made with the help, or more or less completely lock, stock and barrel, by the IDF. We need an IDF logo, you know, because the kind of reporting that I've been complaining about for years in Brussels, where the press is very much too close to the institutions and basically acts as a very sophisticated stenographer to the narrative. This is taken to a whole new level now in Israel, with, you know, and you've got nearly all of these journalists. And what I'm starting to see now with the British journalists is they are literally repeating IDF talking points now. You know, you've got people on air who are just literally reading from the script.
It's because so much is at stake in their minds here, okay, making any kind of admission to terror and all that. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Palestine and free speech. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the Home Edition. To remind you, we're discussing Palestine and free speech. All right, let's go back to George in Budapest. As I said in my introduction, another casualty of these conflicts is free speech. We saw it with Ukraine. You know, if you're against what the United States and NATO was doing, you're a Putin apologist in all of this. It's so tiresome. It's not even worth repeating. But it's on a different magnitude when it comes to. It's always a different magnitude when it comes to Israel, and we saw during particularly the era of Trump, ever since 2015 to the present, the conservative. Defending free speech and denigrating those that, people that need, you know, you're too sensitive, you're a snowflake, you need safe spaces, you know, all of that mockery. Wow. It all came to an end on October 7th, didn't it?
It sure did. So we've had in recent days this extraordinary spectacle of this a demand for censorship of a document that was published more than 20 years ago. This was an open letter by Osama bin Laden to the American people, in which he simply rehashed many of the criticisms that many others have been putting forward against the United States for many, many years. He didn't say anything very new in that, and no one paid any attention to it. I mean, it was up on the Guardian website since 2002. And then some younger people discovered it and recorded short videos of themselves reciting bits and pieces of it on TikTok. And right away, the scream went up. TikTok is, you know, is somehow aiding and abetting, Osama bin Laden's propaganda. It must be taken down immediately. And TikTok, you know, contrary to the claims that it's somehow an agency of the CCP, TikTok was ready to comply and took down all the videos. And the Guardian took down this letter. There was nothing at all in it, but it just shows the extent to which there is just this demand for censorship. And then we've also had Elon Musk, who has been within the crosshairs of many liberals for allowing free speech, because he says something like, "I'm a free speech absolutist." He's not actually, but he claimed to be, and that was enough to trigger throughout Europe and the United States, something needs to be done about Elon Musk. The EU has been only threatening him for a long time. The European Commission said that they're not going to advertise on Twitter. I called it Twitter. I find it hard to call it X.
It's fine. Everybody knows. I think we can say Twitter X. That's my compromise.
Twitter X. And now all the corporations are saying that's it. We're not
IBM, Apple, Disney.
So, that's it. We're not doing it. And so what is his sin? His sin is he's allowing free speech. I mean, it's not like
I guess, George, this is where we are. Martin, free speech is anti-Semitism. Is that where we are now?
It can be. I mean, the thing about free speech, and I say this very much from a journalist perspective, who's been sued at least 6 times by European politicians for defamation, is that free speech is very much open to subjective debate. You know, what is free speech? What I find with free speech is that nearly every single time, people, wealthy people, the elites who complain about we're needing free speech and campaigning for free speech and banging the drum about free speech are never sincere. They never actually really believe in it. What they mean is they want a free speech which works for them. They want a free speech which can be manipulated by wealthy people. And it's already quite well manipulated, because what I don't see with Elon Musk, and I've been following this debate, you know, the whole thing about free speech, Elon Musk is right in one sense, is that free speech is actually pretty ugly. And this is what we don't understand. We don't contemplate this. We don't actually accept this in the day and age of social media, where you can just block people, where you can, harangue all your friends to do the same thing. And you have this woke liberal nonsense now of canceling people. You know, I, as a white, middle-class, middle-aged journalist, I'm not allowed to talk about racism in the UK because I'm not qualified, because I'm not black. And that's how bad it is. That's how ridiculous it is, So free speech is ugly. It really is ugly.
There's an extra wrinkle to it, George. Jews against Zionism. See, that's where it gets really sticky for these people, okay? Because when I think it was Union Station, thousands and thousands of American Jews dressed identically, never again, not in my name. That's pretty powerful. It's amazingly powerful. And it is the greatest indictment against Zionism, particularly in the United States. How do they get out of that? They can't.
No, they can't. And then we have this free speech supposedly on university campuses. And as you were saying, Peter, this was an issue that has been raised repeatedly by conservatives. Universities are the centers for debate. They have a discussion. That's where young people go to grow up and realize that there are many different views on the world. And so, stop being a baby and demand safe spaces. Clearly, there are, only the other day, Rashid Tlaib, no favorite of mine, her talk was banned at the Arizona State University. And we've had all kinds of associations at universities, which supposedly are, pro-Palestinian or anti-Israeli or whatever, and they're getting banned because universities are under pressure from donors, and they're under pressure out of fear of losing government contracts. And so this, you know, and this goes back to the issue with Twitter X, that these corporate powers are very, very susceptible to political activists, often, you know, these liberals who are themselves very lavishly funded, often also from governments, all these various strange organizations fighting digital hate, fighting discrimination, fighting anti-Semitism. They lobby these huge corporations like IBM, and then these corporations wield their massive power to bring people to heel. And so it's very interesting that, you know, we have is essentially kind of the liberal left, which supposedly was for free speech, are actually very happy that the biggest corporations in the world are actually cracking down on speech and bringing it to an end. Oh, that's great. IBM, Apple, Disney, bringing speech to an end. Great. Two thumbs up.
Martin, jump in.
I don't think the liberal left really believe in free speech. I think that's one of
I don't either.
I think that's a really fair. I mean, I've been sued by Neil Kinnock, former Labour leader, for a horrendous amount of money in 2002 when I had a column in Private Eye. And, what people like Neil Kinnock or Elon Musk or any of these elites don't talk about when they talk about free speech is they don't talk about defamation laws, because defamation laws are so advantageous and so crafted for the elites. They're basically built for wealthy people to manipulate. You don't stand a single chance, you know, in a defamation lawsuit against somebody who's got, you know, a few million quid in the bank. And when I went to London and talked to the lawyers at Private Eye, an Etonian chain smoking young man, the first thing he said to me is, "Have you got £25,000? I said, £25,000? Is that how much this case is going to cost? He said, "No, that's how much it's going to cost just to start." So, you know, Elon Musk and Neil Kinnock and the European Commission officials and all these people who bang on about free speech are usually from the liberal left. They don't believe in free speech because they never talk about reforming defamation laws. You know, the defamation laws are so unfairly balanced towards the elite and not towards independent journalists like me. So that's something that jumps out, you know. But whenever I hear about wealthy people talking about free speech, I'm reminded of that very funny cartoon in Private Eye of the High Court judge in his 80s leaning over his desk and pointing a finger at someone and says, "Right, we've heard your views about free speech, now shut up." And that really sums up what the elites think of free speech.
Well, I mean, the same thing can be said, George, is that, you know, free speech is all nice and fine, but Israel in Zionism is of a higher magnitude, a higher cause. And so Zionism trumps free speech. This is essentially what they're saying to us.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And that's why we've seen the deployment of the anti-Semitism weapon, which is entirely ubiquitous because it doesn't really mean anything.
Well, I mean, if everything is anti-Semitic, then nothing is anti-Semitic.
Well, exactly. So today, once again, The Guardian is putting out a story on his front page about Viktor Orban. You know, Viktor Orban once again launching his campaign with anti-Semitic overtones.
But he supported the United States in the United Nations Security Council. Remarkably, it really it stuck out. He's like, Hungary voted that way.
Exactly. That's why it is so ridiculous. But the anti-Semitism weapon is very, very useful to go after your political opponents. It was used a great deal against Trump throughout his years, even though, you know, he did everything that Israel asked for and then some. And, you know, he has this, you know, his son-in-law, which is an intense Zionist activist. That's what you do. You go after your political opponents. And now with this election, which is now less than a year away, we're going to hear a lot more of this, a constant drumbeat of, we saw this, we talked about it on The Gaggle in The Economist about the greatest threat to the world order is Donald Trump getting reelected as president. We're going to see a lot more of this, of the crackdown on free speech and the enormous anti-Semitism threat that's emanating from Trump.
Yeah, but Martin, because of the reach of social media and specific news outlets, I think it's wearing really thin. I mean, they can bang away all they want about what is and isn't anti-Semitism, what words are dangerous. But when you look at those images, those videos, you can't unsee them in your mind. And it breaks you. It breaks me every time I look at it. And it makes me much more resolved to take on these people. Go ahead, call me what you want. I don't care. Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, and it upsets me a lot as well, you know. But what I see from a distance, when I step back, I see this as a consequence of media eroding their own values over the last, I've got friends that I've known for 30 years in the UK who have blocked me now on social media because they are obviously not getting on their timelines, on their social media feeds, anything relating to the atrocities of Palestinians leading up to October the 7th.
Well, I mean, but this is what's happened. This is what's happened here. You know, we had Russiagate. I lost a lot of friends. Okay. Yeah. The 2020 election, I lost a lot of friends. Ukraine, I lost a lot of friends. Now with Gaza, I'm losing a lot more friends. Okay. Because people get obsessed with these certain topics, and they can no longer reason. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Marrakesh, and I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.